Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
For this latest episode of the Cast Review miniseries, I'll be speaking with detransitioner Kira Bell and her lawyer Paul Conrath. Kira Bell is a woman of extraordinary courage and resilience. She's written powerfully about her turbulent childhood and the circumstances which led her to identify as a boy during her teenage years, and ultimately to the gender identity services at the Tavistock Clinic. At just 15, medics affirmed her in her belief that she was a boy. At 16, she was prescribed puberty blockers, and at 17, she was given testosterone. Kira went on to have a double mastectomy at 20, before realising around a year later that she was and always would be female. On recognising that she'd been sold a lie by the NHS, she took the decision to take on the gender identity services in court, where she was represented by Paul. Paul and Kira were interviewed separately, but because their stories are so intertwined, we've combined them for this interview. So thank you so much for joining me, Paul. Really appreciate your time. If I could perhaps just kick off by asking, how did you meet Kira Bell?
Well, Kira was one of the witnesses in the case against the Tavistock. So that's she wasn't originally the claimant, she was a witness, and we were seeking to explain to the court how a medical practice actually played out in practice.
Okay, and how did you come across her case? How did you find the witness, if you like? How did that happen, if that's not a stupid question?
No, I think there were quite a few people involved in that case, and so we were, as we were seeking to build it, I can't remember who, to be quite honest, but there were, we'd said we'd like to have somebody involved who could explain what life looked like if you'd gone through that system. And somehow somebody contacted Kira. She came out of the woodwork and was willing to be involved as a witness. So I'm afraid, so I don't know how she came across my path, but she did. And we were delighted with her courage and her clarity.
Thank you. And what was it that sort of piqued your interest? When did you realise that there was something awry with the treatment of children at the Tavistock? And just how did you become aware of the issue of the sort of increase in numbers of children presenting with gender dysphoria?
Well, I originally became aware of the issue of trans more generally, probably about 6 or 7 years ago, when I returned to legal practice, and I was a friend sent me a document explaining, giving a background really on trans and its impact on public life. And I was recommended to meet with Stephanie Davis Arai, who I was told could fill me in. So I met with her a few times, and she began to explain the background to the trans movement in the UK and its impact in education and healthcare in particular. And I then ended up representing a chap, Harry Miller, who was bringing a case on free speech related to a post that he'd made on Twitter about trans issues. And as a result of that case, I was invited to attend an event in the House of Lords, at which Lord Mooney was the convener, and Posy Parker was arranging it. And there were various speakers there from the States, and also Marcus and Sue Evans. And so it was really at that meeting that I heard in rather lurid detail the experiences of families and the concerns about medical practice at the Tavistock.
Thank you. It's interesting you should mention that meeting, because I was there, and I remember it seems to be a real seminal meeting at which sort of so many important voices were brought together, and it felt like a sort of pivotal moment in the history of this to me. I know that as well. And I know that that a lot of the MPs were threatened not to attend, basically, by the whips, which was just quite shocking.
It was, yes. I mean, there were some, key players in that room, and it wasn't a very big gathering, actually. It was, if you remember, it was probably only about, was it 30 or 40 people, if I remember, something like that.
Pretty small. So I understand that you're sort of your specialist interest with regards to human rights. You've got a particular interest in autism, and I wonder if perhaps that might have informed your understanding of the topic, or if there was any sort of relationship there, because we know that obviously a lot of the children at the Tavistock had diagnoses of Asperger's and various on the autistic spectrum of one stage or another.
Yes, so in terms of autism, I mean, my own background in that area, I mean, I've worked with children with autism for probably 25 years or so, initially as a lawyer years ago, representing, I mean, thousands of families seeking help for their children with autism, and then actually owning a group of schools for children with autism, and then having autism in the family with one of my children. So it's an issue that I've been immersed in for a long time. And so to hear that there was a strong preponderance of autism within the Tavistock in many ways wasn't a surprise. I mean, what you have with people who are on the autistic spectrum, that struggle to connect, that sense of the developing self, who am I? And of course, if you're searching on the internet on questions relating to identity and you're seeking to connect, then you will very likely come across chat rooms and communities that are dealing with the transgender issue. And it's within that forum you can then begin to find a sense of belonging and a sense that maybe this is the answer to my lack of connection. And of course, with autism as well, you have the obsessionality, you have the hyper focus, you have the rigidity of thinking and the lack of nuance. And so the ability to can as a developing teenager, all of these things playing in when you've got this assertion that maybe the answer to your lack of, well, the answer to some of the issues that you're going through is maybe that you've been born in the wrong body. And also I think the sense of community that is found with folks that are struggling maybe to connect, and here is a place of connection and a place of acceptance and a place of being special in some way. So I think maybe some might say that's a little bit simplistic, but that's how I came to recognize that it didn't surprise me that there would be young folk with autism there. And in fact, when I spoke to Professor Christopher Gilberg, who's one of the global authorities on autism and an expert, an expert in autism and also an expert witness in the Keira Bell case. He was very keen to be involved because he was concerned that that group of young people were particularly vulnerable.
And could you give perhaps a sort of a bit of an overview of the case itself? Because I know to start with it was another parent, wasn't it? It was a parent who then later stepped back and was was it Sue Evans? Was she involved, or did I imagine that?
Yes, I mean, the way the case began really is that after that meeting in Parliament, a group of us went to a pub in Westminster, and the discussion was, what can be done? And Sue Evans was in that meeting, and she was asking, what can be done? And so my take on it at the time was I thought a judicial review, a legal case against the Tavistock, potentially for acting unlawfully, could be brought. And the illegality being potentially the lack of young people being able to give informed consent, both in the nature of the information that's being given to them, that they weren't being really told the full story. But secondly, even if they were, how does a child consent to the loss of adult experiences, which would be the inevitable consequence of taking this medical pathway? So it seemed to me that there was a case to run. And we met quite early on, a group of us met with Jeremy Heim, KC, a leading barrister in medical law. And he confirmed that view, that there was a case indeed. That was his view. And Sue Evans decided she wanted to proceed with it. And it was very courageous of her. I mean, because you're putting an awful lot on the line when you're willing to take on the state. And especially, of course, in that area of all areas, because it is a toxic area. It remains that to this day. And you are setting yourself up to be shot at. But nonetheless, she was willing to do that. She had been the first whistleblower in 2008. She felt deeply for the children. She had nothing personal to gain from it. And she was willing to do it. And also there was a mother, Mrs. A, whose child was on the waiting list for the Tavistock, and she was equally concerned because she wanted to protect her child from the treatment. So she was a co-claimant in the case. What was fascinating as we began to build the case early on was the sense of fear and terror as you would speak to experts in this country about the issue. And by that, I mean, you would speak to folk and they would say, I mean, eminent people would say, look, we are really concerned about this, but we're not going to go on the record. We're not going to speak publicly. It's not worth it. And so that was hugely frustrating because you heard there were concerns, but you wanted to present evidence to the court. So we ended up going far and wide, and we had help from the States, help from Sweden, help from Australia, and it really became an international effort in many ways in pulling stuff together, as well as some brave local folk. I think of Michael Biggs, Professor Michael Biggs from Oxford, who was willing to also step up to the plate. Professor Sophie Scott at, I think it's UCL, a neuropsychologist, was willing also to give evidence to the court. So there were some very brave folk locally who were willing to, but we augmented this with some outstanding international experts. I mean, Professor Christopher Gilbert, I've already mentioned, a global authority on autism. Professor Stephen Levine, really a global authority on transgender medicine, having previously really worked on the other side of the fence, if I can put it like that. So we eventually got the team together and put the evidence in before the court. And with this type of case, when you're suing the state, you can't just go, you know, commence your case and then head straight down to trial. There's a gateway process whereby a high court judge has to evaluate, does it look like the state has acted unlawfully? And this case sailed through that process and ended up then at trial. But what was interesting, but as we came to the first trial, came to the trial, should I say, is that along the way, there were wider developments happening. There was a lot of attention from around the world on the case. The National Health Service changed its advice on the reversibility of puberty blockers during the course of the litigation. And during the litigation, the CAS review was commissioned. So there was a lot of wider activity happening as this litigation was creating a platform, really, for this issue to be explored by an independent court. And of course, we then came before the court, and the judges, you know, probed quite seriously the Tavistock's position. And there was a sense of surprise, which is a kind of British understatement, at the lack of evidence, the lack of information that the Tavistock had kept relating to its treatment of these children. And also, of course, the children, I shouldn't say of course, but also the children as young as 10 had been given this treatment, that there'd never been an application to the court where there might be a concern about consent. That for a 13-year-old who was being asked to consider the possible loss of their fertility, that this required some imagination, as one was trying to inform the child of what they were consenting to and the consequences of the treatment. These were all remarkable elements that were coming out during the trial. And it was quite an extraordinary experience to be in court at that time and to have a full court hearing an independent panel of very experienced judges question the Tavistock. I remember at the time Janice Turner from the Times turning up saying, I'm coming along today because I have a sense that history is going to be made. So, and she proved to be very right in that sense.
So, Kira, life would have been easier for you had you stayed quiet about your doubts or perhaps detransitioned out of the public eye and just put in a complaint or something to the Tavistock. But instead, you chose to step up and to take a stand for other vulnerable young people and children. What made you decide to speak out and take a legal case?
I would say it's kind of ultimately my aversion to injustice, really. Because, I mean, when I did bring up my concerns to the Tavistock, for example, this was after I'd already decided to detransition. They gave me like an internal POWS form, which is their complaints procedure. And I just couldn't believe it. That sort of thing just wasn't even on my mind to be making some internal complaint based on, it felt like at the time, like my whole life had been ruined. It was just kind of my aversion to injustice, I would say. And I wanted to make a difference because I knew that this was happening on a larger scale. It wasn't just me or even just a few people. It was, happening on a much wider scale.
Thank you. That's quite shocking about the POWS form. Illustrative, yeah. I think, of their general dismissal of all of this until they were actually forced to take it seriously by the courts.
Exactly.
So, and on that, as I understand that that the Gender Identity Development Service, they didn't release their findings on the puberty blocker trial until the day after the initial ruling. Why do you think that was? And as somebody who I presume you were part of that trial, how did that make you feel?
I wasn't shocked or surprised. I feel like there has been a lot of snaky behavior going on. I don't really know what's going on behind the scenes, so I can't say this or that definitely happened, but it seems very shady to me. But it was kind of expected. I think they must have known that they didn't have the data and that any sort of indication they have of what's going on wouldn't look good. So I think they were trying to obscure that as much as possible, to be honest.
Yeah. I agree for what it's worth. Were there any points during the case, because I imagine it must have been sort of quite draining. Were there any points where you wished you hadn't spoken out? And if you want to go into it, I'm kind of interested to know what the response was like from the so-called trans community.
Yeah, no, I definitely never regretted speaking out. Again, I knew it was the right thing to do. And never at any point had any sort of regrets about speaking out, and that's still the case to this day, because I know it was for the greater good in a genuine way. I remember when I first came out with my story, I don't know, it was kind of a combination of the trans radical activists wanting to destroy any possibility of my story kind of getting out there, and attacks towards me. Absolutely, yeah. But I also had a lot of confused kind of conservative people that thought at the time they were kind of like, oh, well, that's the parents' responsibility. This is a bogus story. That's the parents' responsibility. Or why is the NHS being sued? Or even comments such as, oh, well, if they didn't give this person the drugs that they were asking for, then they would also take them to court then. So there was a lot of kind of misconceptions and just horrible things that were said. And the latter kind of started to diminish as the case kind of revealed itself and what was actually going on. But yeah, it was quite horrible because there was a combination of those confused people as well as the trans radical activists, wanting to destroy my story and me speaking out as much as possible.
The court found, I understand, that puberty blockers deem them to be experimental. And then at appeal, parts of the ruling were overturned. Is that right?
That's right. So the trial court were they never ruled that any practice was unlawful, which is the essence of a judicial review, that you make a finding of unlawfulness, and then the result of that leads to certain changes. Instead, what the court did is what lawyers would call an advisory declaration. They set out the various things that a child or a young person would have to understand to consent lawfully to the treatment and express their own views on whether children of certain ages would be able to consent. As I think the judgment said at one point, it's just not good enough giving lots of information over and over again. You've got to be sure that a child can really understand it. And there was a sense of disbelief in the judgment that young children could really understand the lifelong consequences that they were signing up to. Anyway, that was in the High Court, and that was the success. It goes to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal effectively said that the trial court had overstepped the mark and was stepping into the role of doctors, and it wasn't for them to be assessing capacity, as it were. That wasn't the role of the, or giving guidance on capacity in the way that they did. That was impermissible. And there was concerns about the expert evidence that that wasn't really, that this particular court process wasn't geared up to evaluate the evidence as the trial court had done. And so the appeal was overturned. So the original judgment was overturned. However, of course, by that time, there had been very significant changes. And the NHS had paused referrals to the Tavistock. And then when I think they when that was lifted, a multidisciplinary team was put in place to assess whether the children who are being referred for puberty blocking treatment should be referred. So there was a second tier of protection for these children, which really began to slow down and limit the amount of hormonal treatment that was being given to the children. And of course, the CAS review was underway. And also in the meantime, we had the CQC do its investigation into the Tavistock and found that its practice was inadequate. So there's a lot of activity going on. And really, although we lost on appeal, which was a great shame, nonetheless, there had been huge changes that had taken place and were taking place that were connected to the case.
Do you think the overturning of certain parts of the original judgment really matters, given what the case drew into the open? I mean, essentially, do you think the CAS review would have happened without your case?
From what I could see, it definitely triggered the CAS review. It was kind of everything was kind of snowballing at that time as well. You could see doors opening, more people speaking out. It was kind of a it was there was a lot of pressure on the NHS by that point, I think. but they also left the door open towards the end of the ruling to sort of say, well, if there are any patients who have been a victim of negligence, then they should absolutely come to the courts and deal with those matters on a more personal level. So, but yeah, ultimately, I don't think that overturn being overturned on appeal, I don't think that really has it doesn't really have much standing in the wider context of it all being a negligent practice.
And I mean, you sort of suggest, do you think there might be more cases following in your footsteps now from detransitioners taking legal action?
Absolutely. I mean, there definitely already has been, especially in the States. But yeah, there's it's been all over, really, here in the UK, Australia. I think it's just gonna get worse and worse as far as the amount of cases and people suffering.
What a shame it's got to come to that to make change. And I suppose something that Cass noted in her review was that she wanted a service for detransitioners to be included in any sort of redesign of NHS services in this area. What do you think that should look like? What do you need? What do detransitioners need? How many of you are there that you know of?
I would say it needs to be a combination of things. I would say I think therapy should definitely be offered, but I also don't want to be too idealistic, because lots of people in this country and all over the Western world require therapy to some degree, and I know that the funding is just not there. At least for it to be a smooth, helpful service, because I've been in and out of NHS therapy for a long time, and yeah, it's not really helped. So I don't want to be too idealistic, but that would be the goal, though. Some sort of therapeutic, or even management of emotions, kind of like a more practical version of that. Excuse me. So something like that, as well as there needs to be physical support, so investigations into our health, basically health checkups and seeing what can be done there. But yeah, hopefully most people will have some level of support in their personal lives as well. But yeah, I would say it's something I would like to think on a bit more, to be honest, because I think it's again, it's such a complex situation to be in, that I wouldn't like to say, oh, this is the way and this is the only thing that's going to help detransitioners, because we are so broad and diverse. So, but I would say those are the fundamentals, really.
Thank you. That's interesting. And is there a community growing of detransitioners, and are you able to just sort of give each other peer support?
I think so on the whole. I will admit I've kind of taken a pretty big step back, and I don't really talk to many unless they're already kind of they've already met me, or they we've spoken before. But yeah, I kind of keep to myself, and I think it's been good for my mental health to not be involved or not speak on it directly, because again, I think one of the helpful things is to not, you know, you asked, for example, what support we need in services, and I think not harping on transition or detransition itself is really quite integral to our recovery. I think we need to focus on managing and living life, basically. So yeah, pulling away from anything in regards to this topic, for the most part, has been quite helpful.
Thank you. And well, you know, with regard to that, thank you so much for agreeing to do this, because yeah, I appreciate it. It must be frustrating to constantly be asked about something that is both political and personal, I guess. What do you think this sort of the longer term impact of the case might have been or might still be? Do you think there are still sort of ramifications which haven't yet played out, which might do so? Or do you think that's kind of, do you think the Cass Review was the sort of the apogee of the, you know, do you think there's anywhere else to go with it?
Yes, I think, well, first of all, just to say that I think one of the critical things that the case did is it shone a light on the practice. And that was hugely helpful. And of course, Dr. Cass has done an outstanding job in not only, you know, referring to what happened at the Tavistock, but also a broader review of this type of this medical treatment for gender dysphoria. But Dr. Cass's report really is a staging post on the journey. It's highlighting the problem in with great authority over several years and huge amount of work that's gone into it. But there is much more yet to be done. And so I don't think for one moment one can sit back and say that that's the job done. Quite the opposite. In many ways, the job is just beginning. So what we do know as a result of Cass is that the NHS no longer commissions puberty blockers, even in exceptional circumstances. So that is a huge change. That's within the NHS. We know that within the NHS, cross-sex hormone treatment has to be approved by an independent multidisciplinary team that are not treating the child. So that's a second tier of protection. And that there's going to be a proper consultation on the approach that should be adopted with cross-sex hormones. So just like it's happened with puberty blockers, that's going to happen with cross-sex hormones. So that is a huge step forward for the NHS, much more protective approach. And critically, the NHS saying our primary approach now is psychosocial. So this is great news for young people who are experiencing gender dysphoria. But it's not the end of the story, because we also have the private sector. And so there's the possibility that young people could get hormonal treatment that has huge lifelong consequences from the private sector within the UK. Private doctors, or a private clinic. And there's unregulated providers, I mean, unregulated by the British authorities in terms of the Care Quality Commission. So you've got Gender GP I believe others that offer an online service. And these are real concerns here that young people can access very powerful drugs without a much more cautious approach that's been informed by CAST. And so there is a concern there. There's a concern, I think, about what's being taught in schools and in terms of gender ideology and the thought that actually you might be born in the wrong body. And these ideas being given some degree of authority within the education system is a concern. I think there's also the concern of the degree to which institutions have been, institutions have adopted a particular philosophical approach that affirms gender ideology and denies biological sex in terms of a kind of more binary approach to our sexed lives. So that these are areas that I think there's much work still to be done. And I think also the training of our professionals that work in these fields, that they are given unbiased training that flows out of the research that Dr. Cass has done. So there's an awful lot to be done. And also then there's the adult service, where if you're 17, you're covered by two approaches within the NHS. You've either got the children's service with all of its caution, or you can be treated under the adult approach, where you just need two appointments, no psychological work, and you can be on the medication, and then a year after have the surgery. So the adult service, and especially for young adults, 17 to 25, is an area of huge concern, and a spotlight needs to be shone on that.
Are there any legal cases upcoming that you're aware of that that it might be worth keeping an eye out for or following?
Yes. Well, there are a few at the moment. So the president of the family division has just handed down judgment in the case of Ree J. That's a case where there's a dispute between parents over the medical treatment that their child with gender dysphoria should receive. And the particular focus of that case was on gender GP and the service that they had offered to this young person who has had a very challenging background, autism, significant mental health issues, being sectioned for anorexia, and the really appalling treatment that this young person received from gender GP, such that the president of the family division has issued effectively a warning or advice to all courts that they should have extreme caution in dealing with any case that comes before them concerning gender GP, and his general concern for the safety of parents, of patients, shall I say, who are accessing gender GP. So that is a case that's a judgment's just been given that really is an invitation to the state. Maybe invitation is too soft a word. A rocket to the state to do something to protect young people from online providers of this medication. So that's one area, that's one case that's of relevance. We currently have a judicial review running concerning the licensing of Gender Plus Hormone Clinic. That's the first paediatric clinic in the UK. That clinic has been is led by ex-Tavistock clinicians. And there's a concern that the licensing of that clinic may be unlawful. The CQC has acted wrongly in it, and effectively by licensing the clinic, this is exposing young people to a treatment that is not evidenced as safe and effective. So there's that case that's running through the courts at the moment. We have another case at the moment relating to the adult service and challenging the approach there as lacking appropriate protection for young people. So that's another case that is going at the moment.
Thank you. If I may ask you, I'm just sort of curious about the role of, I suppose, activist lawyers on the other side, as it were. So I know that the tax lawyer, Jolyon Maugham, and his Good Law Project have been sort of putting forward lots of cases to in their words, support trans youth, but basically to undo a lot of the work that's been done with regards to the CAS review and just urging watchful waiting and caution. Do you see that as a threat? Do you think there's any chance of them actually challenging anything successfully?
Well, one of the interesting elements of losing the Keira Bell case in the Court of Appeal was the Court of Appeal said, look, really, this is a very controversial area and we need to leave it up to the medical authorities and Parliament to sort this out. So the medical authorities have pronounced with CAS. So I think the Bell v Tavistock case in the Court of Appeal strengthens the position of the CAS review because the courts have said it's a complicated area. Well, let's see what the specialists have to say. And Dr. CAS has spoken. So I think that ironically has given greater protection to a more cautious viewpoint, but I don't put it past activists in bringing litigation. And I think I would say, you know, our concern, you know, we're not, although one refers to the culture wars, what's absolutely critical is we're talking about children and young people and families that are going through a really difficult time. And critically, these children need help. And so where there are challenges brought that are trying to get the young people help, appropriate help, then, you know, one would cheer that on, actually, and wish them all the best. It's just where there is a promotion of a treatment approach that really lacks the evidence base to be safe and effective that we have, you know, real serious concerns.
Thank you. Is there anything else you think I should cover that I haven't covered that you want to sort of go into at all?
I think you might want to say, actually, one thing I haven't covered is how Keira Bell became the lead claimant.
Yeah, go on then.
That was a key. That was a change. I might as well say, you know, so when the case was launched against the Tavistock, it was brought originally by Sue Evans and by Mrs. A. But early on in the litigation, Sue was going through huge challenges outside of the court process and so had to retire from the litigation. And at that point, Keira Bell said, you know, she was willing to take Sue's place. And so that was contested. The Tavistock contested that she shouldn't be allowed to, but the judge approved her being appointed as the claimant. And I think when she was appointed, that was hugely significant for the case, because I think people probably thought that's what we'd planned all along, which we hadn't. But with Keira being the lead claimant and her courage and her clarity really laid bare for everyone the implications of what this treatment meant for a young person. And it was iconic and tragic, really, to hear her story. And yet her bravery has had an extraordinary influence. And it's fair to say, from my experience anyway, that as a result of that case, I am approached from people all around the world in various guises, whether concerned groups or people advising government, say, please, can you speak to us about, and please, can we speak to Keira Bell? More to the point, and there's nothing like hearing it from her rather than a dry lawyer trying to explain legal matters.
I don't think you've been dry at all in this, so I very much appreciate your time, and thank you so much.